From NPR News, this is News in Notes. I'm Tony Cox in for Farai Chidea. People around the world are starting to like the United States again, well, at least a little bit. Barack Obama makes plans to visit Iraq and Afghanistan, and devastated by weeks of flooding, Iowans compare their floods to Katrina. Here to talk about all of it is Ron Christie, Vice President of the lobbying group DC Navigators. He is also a former special assistant to President George W. Bush. And we're also joined by Mary Frances Berry, a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. She is also the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. Hey, folks.
Hey there.
Hello there.
Nice to have you with us again. Let's begin with this. It seems that countries around the world are starting to like us again. A recent study by the Pew Research Center says that America's image is improving globally, but America's image is still more negative than positive. So, Ron, the Pew Global Attitudes Project included about 24,000 people in about 24 countries, give or take, including America. What does the world think of America, and how concerned should we be about our image?
I think the world still looks at the United States as the greatest beacon of freedom and democracy in the world. We are a very generous people. We're a very generous nation. And this upcoming election, in fact, this November, proves that the United States has really fought to bring people together of all different religions and races. And you have an African-American who's running at the top of the ticket for the Democrats, who was originally contested by the first woman major candidate. I think what the poll also shows, though, is a skewed towards the United States that is not a proper one. I think there is a improper perception of the United States as being a suppressor of economic rights and a emitter of global greenhouse emissions that I think is not properly founded. So overall, I don't think that this poll is going to hurt the United States in any way, shape, or form. I think it just solidifies that there are many friends and many allies around the world who respect us for who we are.
Mary, what do you make of this report card?
Well, the key seemed to be that everyone is happy that Bush is leaving. Bush is still a drag on America's image. People think he's made bad decisions about the war and everything else. And also, in addition to what Ron said, some people in those countries believe that our economic policies have created problems for them, whether it's on trade or whether it's on emissions or whatever it is, that they feel like the United States has been perpetrating indignities that have led to their detriment. They also like the idea of Obama symbolically being just the symbol of being the guy who has got the nomination and maybe the president. Although it was interesting that the poll showed that in two of the countries in the poll, United States and Jordan, McCain polled better than Obama. I thought that was interesting. Mm-hmm. And I can't figure out what was going on there. But in any case, the image is still bad, but it's improving. And mostly it's hope. People think that something will change and they're tired of what exists and they want something new.
Does it surprise you, Ron, that the level of interest in America, particularly during this election cycle, is so high around the world?
It doesn't surprise me. I think that, again, for having had a woman and an African-American gentleman vie for the Democratic nomination and then having Senator McCain as the Republican nominee, I think people around the world are focused on how might Senator Obama or Senator McCain change the direction of the course of the United States? How would either of those two gentlemen impact their particular nation? So it doesn't surprise me. I am always amazed when I travel around the country or travel to different countries of how closely people watch our country in general for culture. But it's very, very interesting to note that they're actually tuning in for a political rather than cultural notion of, hey, something's going on in the United States that we need to pay attention to.
You know, to follow that point, Ron, one interesting note from the survey was that 83% of people in Japan said that they were following the U.S. election news very closely. That's 3% more than here in the United States. That surprise you, Mary?
Well, I couldn't tell, really. I thought that was great, but they didn't compare it with a cycle of previous elections and go back far enough for me to tell whether it was that different, although I assume that it is from everything else that I have heard. The countries are right to pay attention to what goes on here. We still are the greatest power with the most influence in the world. And part of what goes on with our elections is not just politics, especially this time. It is also culture. It's cultural. A phenomenon is sweeping the nation. There's some kind of transformation. And Obama is hot. And you had Clinton as a woman. And there are all these symbols going on at the same time. So it's not just pure politics and pure rationality about one's interests. But they need to pay attention, and it was good that they are.
We're going to move on to another topic, but before we do, there's one more question. I want to put it to you, Mary. And it comes from another Pew survey out this week that I thought was pretty interesting. It asked Americans, in this case, were they concerned about our nation's global image? And the answer was resoundingly, yes, they are concerned. Republicans and Democrats saw it as a major problem during the election cycle, the GOP less so, but still, that is a concern in an election year, isn't it?
Yes, one thing is just not being liked. I mean, you hate to go places and find out that people just don't like you or your country and your leaders. And also, you worry about policy. You worry about danger to you if people think that your interests are so much different from theirs and that you're some kind of evil influence in the world. Nobody likes that, and that puts us in a very dangerous position. So it's time for a change, and Americans should be worried about our image abroad.
Ron, presumptive Democratic nominee Barack Obama says he plans to visit Iraq and Afghanistan before the fall election. While in Michigan this week, he reiterated his intentions to pull troops out as soon as he becomes president. But he also says something else. He says that he is concerned that President Bush will make some sort of binding armed forces agreement with Iraq right before he leaves office. Do you think this is likely to happen?
I honestly don't know what Senator Obama is talking about. I'm pleased that he has decided to visit the region. He has been giving a lot of rhetorical flourishes to his speeches of late, saying that the United States went the wrong way with the war in Iraq, that we diverted our attention from what was going on in Afghanistan. So I'm pleased that he will actually return to the region to talk to our men and women in uniform who are waging and winning this war on terrorism and getting their perspective rather than touching up his rhetorical flourishes and ruffles, if you will. But at the same time, the Commander-in-Chief of the United States will remain George W. Bush until next January. And it's rather presumptuous, I think, of the junior senator from Illinois to discuss what the Commander-in-Chief's options may or may not be they with bilateral agreements between two countries or working out specific arrangements with the United Nations or other world bodies. So it is presumptuous at this juncture to talk about what the Commander-in-Chief may or may not do for military options that are available to our men and women in uniform. But again, to wrap up, I am pleased that Senator Obama is going to the region. Either Senator Obama or Senator McCain will be the next commander-in-chief, and they need to see firsthand how the policies will affect our people in uniform.
I'm going to put a two-parter to you, Mary, and give you an opportunity to speak briefly about the issue of Barack going to Iraq. But the major question I want to put to you is this. In other news, it was reported that Senator Hillary Clinton will have a fundraiser with some of her top contributors who seem to be frustrated with Obama's campaign. Apparently, many of the Clintons' top donors have complained that Obama has not reached out to them. So my two-parter is really briefly on Iraq, and secondly, is who is supposed to woo whom, Clinton or Obama's?
On Iraq, I think that it's old news that we were lied to and misled and went into Iraq for the wrong reason. That's old news. That's very old news. I think everybody in America has figured that out by this time. The new news is, what do we do now? And so he needs to go so that he will modify, if need be, his plans if he becomes president, and maybe some of the rhetoric leading up to it that fits with conditions on the ground now as opposed to whatever happened back then. As far as who's supposed to woo whom, I think that the Obama campaign, if it needs the money, and I don't know how much money they've got, needs to woo the Clinton donors in order to get their money. And that Hillary Clinton, if they don't need their money, then that's fine. They can go ahead without it. If Hillary Clinton, I think, should do everything she can to establish a record that she's tried to be helpful. And so far she has, and I think she will continue to do that. But it's up to the Obama. I've heard some rumblings, too, from people around the country about even some of them who had supported Obama saying that they're not reaching out to them now. That's been happening from some of the pastors in the black community who are complaining about that. But in any case, I think it's up to the Obama campaign if he wants to bring the party together, heal the party, and if he needs the money to reach out, and that Clinton should help. And I think that she's doing that.
Let's switch gears entirely in the last minute or so that we have, Ron. I want to come to you on this because Iowa, as we all know, has been hit very hard with storms and flooding. 40,000 people or more have been displaced in Iowa and a few other states by 2 weeks of flooding. Associated Press giving some numbers. 24 people have died, another 148 injured since June 6th. And there could be more trouble on the way. Some are making a comparison in the Midwest between this and Katrina. What do you say to that, Ron?
They're two entirely different situations. The city of New Orleans was destroyed by an act of God through a Category 4 hurricane when the levees in New Orleans had been built to sustain a Category 3. I think that there was insufficient planning at all levels of government to deal with Katrina. But I have been very encouraged by the state and local response in Illinois and in the upper Midwest to confront this tragedy. And it's one thing that this is a non-political, non-partisan issue. Those who need water, who need help, who need assistance should get it. And I'm pleased that the government at all levels has been responding very, very swiftly to confront these floods.
There's another difference. Not as many people have, as far as we know, died in this thing. Thank goodness that they haven't, but they haven't. Some of the conditions are horrendous. And I love Iowa, and in particular the University of Iowa, and my friends out there, and have walked that whole campus. And I hope that they don't get too flooded. Cedar Rapids. The poor people who live down in the lowlands are the ones that you see in the shelters, or the ones who have been flooded out. The people who are wealthier live on the hill. So I think that there are some similarities. I don't see the same kind of incompetence, at least it's not apparent yet. We don't have a brownie who's done a heck of a job yet.
All right. Let's talk about Governor Blanco Mayor Nagin.
We're going to stop it. We're going to bring it to a close right there. We've run out of time, you guys. We've got to stop it. Right here, Mary and Ron, appreciate it. Mary Frances Berry, a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. She is also the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. And Ron Christie is the vice president of the lobbying group DC Navigators. He is also a former special assistant to President George W. Bush. They both spoke to us from our headquarters in Washington, D.C. This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. This election season, there's a good chance you have donated money online or watched a political video on YouTube. A new survey shows how the internet is transforming the relationship between voters and the candidates. Jeffrey Bennett is the web producer for News and Notes. He joins me now to explain. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Tony.
So tell us about this new survey.
Well, it was conducted by the Pew Internet and American Life Project, and it shows how our online habits have changed during the 2008 election. The level of online activism has spiked, given that more people are directly engaged, either forwarding emails or reading campaign literature or, as you said, watching videos on YouTube. So here are a few highlights. Nearly half of Americans have used the internet, email, and text messaging to get political news. During this campaign, the number of people who have made political contributions online is triple that of 2004, and 35% of Americans have watched a political video online. That's three times the number in 2004.
Now, we all know about the death of NBC's Tim Russert this week, but that hit the blog pretty heavily too, didn't it?
It did. And Moji Odorinde, who's one of our readers, wrote, "I will miss Tim Russert profoundly. I know there are many journalists who are well-gifted, but I've got to be honest, it just won't be the same." And on our blog, we have a piece from Gwen Ifill of PBS who wrote for The Root, and she wrote about how Russert's had impacted her career and life. And a reader named Vanita Fluker read that and wrote, "I have always considered Gwen Ifill solid, balanced, and brutally honest. If we have truly moved forward on race, I find no one else more competent to sit at the head of the Meet the Press table but Miss Ifill."
Now, another big story, Tiger Woods, of course, winning the U.S. Open, 14th major title. We now know he's out for the rest of the season. Yeah. What are people saying about him?
Well, a guy named Paul Consiglio wrote, "Tiger Woods must join Muhammad Ali as the greatest." And the morning after Woods was celebrating his win, New York Mets manager Willie Randolph was getting a pink slip. So we talked about his firing on the blog as well, to which a reader named Don W. wrote, "Willie Randolph is a class act, and I know he will be successful in the future with some other team. He will come back." So we'll see.
We'll have to see. Some of the other big stories on the blog this week.
People are still talking about R. Kelly. There's no shortage of opinions about that and his acquittal. And NASCAR getting slapped with a $225 million racial and sexual discrimination lawsuit. So we have all the details about that in our blog.
Yeah, we often use the web to reach out to our listeners for input or for help. What are we looking for this week?
Well, for a series of upcoming reports, we're looking for people who can tell us how much gas costs per gallon where they live, how gas prices have affected their daily life, if at all, and if they've considered getting rid of their SUV for a more fuel-efficient car. So if so, if that fits the bill for anybody, they can hit us up at nprnewsandviews.org.
All right, Jeffrey Bennett, thank you so much. Jeffrey Bennett is the web producer for News and Notes, joining me right now from our studios here at NPR West. Thanks again, Jeff. Now it's time to see what other stories are heating up the blogosphere. Are black conservatives deserting the GOP for Obama? Plus, blogging can get you arrested in some countries, and the demise of a sock puppet modeled after Barack Obama. With us on our roundtable today is Carmen Van Kerkhove. She blogs at Racialicious and is also the co-founder and president of New Demographic, an anti-racism training company. Wayne Hicks, known in the blogosphere as The Villager. He writes the blog Electronic Village. And former Los Angeles Superior Court Judge Kevin Ross. He blogs at Three Brothers and a Sister and hosts the Kevin Ross Show on Blog Talk Radio. Welcome, everybody.
Thank you for
Thanks for having us.
Let's start. Topic number one. A recent story about black conservatives is getting quite a bit of buzz online. It talks about how Barack Obama's candidacy has created conflicting emotions for some black Republicans. Many are wrestling over whether to vote for the black candidate or stick with the GOP. Talk show host Armstrong Williams, for example, is quoted as saying, "I have never voted for a Democrat for president. That could change this year with Barack Obama," end quote. Kevin, let's start with you. Does being a black conservative mean never having to vote for a Democrat unless he's wildly popular and black?
Well, Tony, this black Republican is in mourning because I am a diehard Lakers fan. And the reason that I make it a point to talk about the NBA championship is when you look at this matchup between the Boston Celtics and the Lakers, you jump back 20 years ago, and there was a racial dynamic to the Larry Bird, the Danny Ainge, the Kevin McHale versus Magic and Worthy and Kareem. And yet 20 years later, when you watch the game as an African-American, I found myself thinking, well, you know what? Even though my Lakers didn't win, it was a black coach. I love to see this brother from Inglewood, California, take home the MVP award. And so now I'm just enjoying the sport for the sake of basketball, and I'm not dealing with the racial dynamics and so forth. As a black Republican who voted for John McCain in the primary here in California, I'm looking forward to the day where we can talk about politics and leaders and people who are going to move this country without talking about race. And that's why even for me, I'm the same way. I'm looking at voting for Obama. I understand it. I get it. And really, for me, it's about Katrina, and it's about my two boys that I'm saying to them, look, you can do anything you want, including being president of the United States.
Well, let me bring Carmen in to talk about that, because is voting, in your opinion, Carmen, voting for somebody primarily because of their race, ethnicity, or religion, is that ever a good idea?
I'm not sure that it's ever a good idea. And actually, this particular article seems to suggest that several of these black conservatives are pro-Obama because they think that Obama wants to move, you know, quote unquote, beyond race. And I find that his campaign has often been called post-racial. And I think that that's a label that people who have really put on him, I haven't really seen Senator Obama describe himself as post-racial. And I think that's a little bit of a reductive view of his stance on race. I mean, in his speech on race, he talked about white privilege. He talked about institutional racism. And he clearly wants to change the way we approach race. But I don't know that he really believes that we're ready to just make it a complete non-issue. So I would caution against really viewing his campaign as an attempt to completely, you know, negate the whole idea of race altogether.
Well, Wayne, one blogger writes, and here's a quote, "When Republican diehards like Armstrong Williams and former former Congressman J.C. Watts are considering Obama, it really is another firm indicator that the Republican brand of dog food isn't selling. That's a quote. What do you say to that?
And I think that's a key element of it. If the Republican candidate against Obama had been more firmly supported by the true-blooded conservatives in their party, that would not be as much of a choice. The fact is, John McCain is not beloved by the conservative wing of his party, and so it becomes a little easier for those black Republicans, as you have cited, to think about Barack Obama. I think the other thing that comes to mind for me is that whether we want to call him post-racial, whether we want to think that race is not an element, you know, the reality is that we live in a nation where race is part of the fabric of our everyday existence. It was the clear issue of the 20th century. I'm not convinced yet that we have gotten beyond it in the 21st century. And so it is wonderful for me to see a talented African-American man that is vying for the highest office in the land. And I encourage all Americans to look at him for his talents. But I will also tell you that for my child, my 8-year-old boy, my 11-year-old daughter, it is my 15-year-old daughter, it is wonderful for them to be able to see this occur this year.
Kevin, talk about, because you're a black Republican, talk about how difficult it is, if it is difficult, to even consider this. For example, there are rumors that Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, former Secretary of State Colin Powell, former Congressman J.C. Watts, as we said, all considering even voting for Obama or supporting him in some way. How hard is that for a black Republican?
For me, it's not an issue, because when I look at voting as a Republican, I'm probably going to vote Republican all the way down the line. My congressman is a Republican. A lot of the elected officials in my area are Republicans. So it's not a question of, am I going straight down the Democratic ticket? You know, the fact of the matter is, when you look at the fact that Shirley Chisholm in 1972 was the first African-American and woman to run for office, and then we had Jesse Jackson in 84 and 88. We had Al Sharpton in 2004, along with Carol Moseley Braun. Lenora Fulani also ran in 1998 with Jesse Jackson. Black folks understand that we've had choices to vote for other black people. So it's not just because we're black, we're voting for someone else that's black. The issue for us and for me is, like I said, two things. My 10-year-old and 6-year-old boys, they keep saying to me, why do you keep making us watch this? And I'm saying to them, because this is history and it's letting you know that there is nothing that you cannot do. And for a father, when I look at a J.C. Watts, when I look at a Colin Powell, I think that they're looking at it from a standpoint of history, and you just cannot deny that this is the best candidate as an African-American, same as Jackie Robinson was for baseball. It's that same type of analogy where years from now we'll be saying, wow, we really did see something just so much bigger than us. It's really just beyond politics at this
point.
Let
me just make sure I'm understanding you correctly, because you talked about voting, and I try not to make it too personal. Voting a straight Republican ticket, and yet I hear you say that you're in favor of Obama because of what he represents. So are you a supporter of – are you a black Republican supporter of Obama?
Absolutely. I am an African-American Republican who lives amongst other Republicans who are saying to me, so you're voting for McCain, right? And I'm like, voted for him in the primary, was not prepared to switch sides. But in the general election, I will be voting for Barack Obama.
All right, let's move on.
We may have the Bradley effect in reverse.
exactly, Wayne. Governor Bradley. I mean, would have been Governor Bradley.
Yeah, Mayor Tom Bradley, right, who ran for governor of California, got oh so close, but the black vote didn't turn out for him.
And nor did the white vote.
All right, let's talk about something else that affects all of you. Bloggers getting arrested. According to the University of Washington, more and more bloggers are getting arrested worldwide for publishing their opinions online, and apparently that extends not just from China and Egypt and Iran, but into Western Europe, in Britain, in France, out here in Canada, and even in the United States. Carmen, do you think the rise in arrests correlates to the greater popularity of blogs?
I definitely think that the two are related. And while in the U.S., at least as far as I know, we haven't had necessarily any wave of blogger arrests, a lot of people have been fired from their jobs for blogging. And so I think that, you know, what this really points to is that blogging is this new form of media, and people are not quite prepared to really handle it, and they're not quite sure how to categorize blogging. You know, does it count as media, or is it just a personal activity that happens to be publicly available online? So I think that, you know, as blogging continues to develop and as other forms of social media continue to develop, I think we're going to see a lot of organizations and, you know, governments, quite frankly, really trying to grapple with this new phenomenon.
Wayne, let me ask you kind of a personal question, as I did with Kevin, because we're talking about bloggers being jailed for what they write. Would you still blog if you faced a threat of arrest and possible jail time? And before you answer, let me just say this. The report found the average prison sentence for blogging was 15 months, and the longest was 8 years.
I mean, quite frankly, blogging for
me
is
Wayne.
A hobby.
Yeah, Wayne. Yeah,
How dedicated are you?
Blogging for me is a hobby, so I'm not at a point yet where I have content that would cause me to, you know, feel a need to be arrested for 15 months. I will say that my attitude is based on the fact that I live in the United States, and so I do think it's unlikely that that type of thing would happen in the United States. You know, it's quite different. I would imagine there'll be a whole lot more of arrests in China as we move towards the Olympics, the Beijing Olympics, and towards the protests that are going on based on China's their human rights abuses in Tibet and Darfur and other places. But, you know, quite frankly, for me at this stage, it's a hobby that I enjoy very much. It's not a vocation. It's not a religion for me.
I would go to jail, Tony.
Would you go to jail?
I would absolutely go to jail. And I say that to say that when I look at the civil rights movement of the 60s and individuals were being taken to jail because they were trying to establish that civil rights needed to be accomplished by the means that they undertook that avoided violence, but yet made the statement that this is how important this is. When I go on Racialicious, which I've been on Carmen's site, which is incredible, and I've gone to Wayne's site as well, they're giving me information just like I get from LATimes.com or CNN.com. So for me, and, you know, there's some that I have to discriminate from a standpoint of credibility, but for me, this is a news source, and this is a venue that I see needs the same protections as any other First Amendment individuals in journalism.
Now, you were a Superior Court judge.
Yes.
Would you send a blogger to jail?
Well, you know, it depends on the circumstances. If we're talking about some criminal conduct that rose to the level of someone being jailed, and if jail was an option as opposed to being mandated, if the law said you must give this person X sentence, well, then I'd have to follow the law. But if it was a discretion thing, then I would say, well, let's look at it the same way I would look at a reporter from any other news source. And I would say, you know, let's look at what the person did, and is that the right punishment from a standpoint of rehabilitation or you know, measuring it with the actual weight of the offense. But there's a story out right now, this gentleman, DeMarcus Ware. He is a Dallas linebacker, a Dallas Cowboys linebacker. There was a story about him adopting a child, and the picture shows a baby that looks white. And so the blogosphere is going crazy about why did this black couple, rich, famous, so forth, adopt this white child? And yet there's no mention of the race of the child. And so what you have is, you know, because some blogger said that the child is white just based on looking at the child. I mean, when I look at my kids, they could have been perceived as white when they were born. There is now this big brouhaha about the importance of adopting black children. That's an example of the power that the blogosphere has right now to move stories, to move issues such as race and politics and so forth. And so I see it as being that necessary, just like we see the First Amendment for journalists.
Well, we've got less than a minute, and I'm going to come to you, Carmen, to give you the last word on the subject, whether or not you would be willing to go to jail for what you blog.
Well, if I was facing the possibility of jail for doing the kind of blogging that I do, then probably I would be living in a state where talking about race is basically forbidden. And since that is the crux of my activism and the stuff that I'm passionate about, then I guess in that situation, yes, I would be.
I want to thank all of you for participating. We didn't say anything today that would get any of you arrested, I don't think. We've been talking
with
Carmen Van Kerkhove, who blogs at Racialicious. She was at our New York studios. Wayne Hicks, otherwise known as The Villager, writes the blog Electronic Village. He was at member station WGUC in Cincinnati, Ohio. And former Los Angeles Superior Court Judge Kevin Ross, who blogs at Three Brothers and a Sister. He was with me here at our NPR West studios. You can find links to their blogs and ours at nprnewsandnotes.org. And the conversation doesn't stop here. Our online series, Speak Your Mind, gives you a chance to sound off on the issues you care about. To find out how, go to our blog, nprnewsandviews.org, and click on Speak Your Mind. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. Last Sunday, presidential candidate Barack Obama took to the pulpit at a church on the south side of Chicago. He'd come to share a few words about African-American fatherhood on Father's Day. Here's some of what he said.
Too many fathers are AWOL, missing from too many lives and too many homes. They've abandoned their responsibilities. They're acting like boys instead of men. Some of it has to do with the failures of our government, and those failures are real. But we can't keep on using that as an excuse. We need fathers to recognize that responsibility doesn't just end at conception. So I resolved many years ago that it was my obligation to break the cycle. That if I could do anything in life, I would be a good father to my children. That if I could do anything, I would give them that rock, that foundation on which to build their lives.
Those were clips from the speech Barack Obama gave last Sunday at the Apostolic Church of God in Chicago. Lynn Toler is a regular contributor to this program. She is also the star of TV's Divorce Court. For years, Lynn has seen the issues facing African-American fathers up close. She's here with us now. Judge, how are you?
I'm fine, Tony. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Your reaction to what you heard, and what did you make of the overall tone of that speech?
Well, my reaction is I believe what he says is the appropriate new wave of African-American response to the situations and the troubles that we have, acknowledging that, in fact, there are hurdles that we have had to get over and difficulties with racism and all of that must be dealt with. But it's a multifaceted problem, so it has to have a multifaceted response. And one response is a personal responsibility piece that he says he's taken on and that he believes that we have to kind of adopt in our hearts as a culture. It's pretty much what Bill Cosby said and got skewered for. I think it is the necessary next wave of how the movement is going to respond to the concerns that we have as a people.
You know, I certainly had that same reaction, that it sounds an awful lot like what Bill Cosby was saying, which got him in such hot water. This is an election year, of course, and Barack Obama is wildly popular with a lot of folks. Who was this speech directed toward, do you think? Just black folks or more?
Oh, has to be more. That man knows what he's doing. He knows that everything he says is not going to be contained within the structure of the black community or black church. He knows white folks were listening. And I think he was speaking to that. He wanted to say, hey, look, we're not going to keep banging on the door. It's not all your fault. We're going to take responsibility for what we're doing. And though I agree with that as a people and the conversation from black on black, I understand that he was saying that in part to let the white community know I'm not just about asking for more that for my people, that I'm asking for more of my people.
Is that sort of kicking? How should I say this? You know, that's an old, and I don't want to use the word tired, but let's just say an issue that's been played over and over and over again in terms of the black fathers and in media and elsewhere. Is this going too far? You know what I'm trying to say?
I'm right with you. I hear you. And it doesn't make it any the less true.
Well, now, you're right about that.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It is true. Whether you're pandering to the truth or you're addressing it and trying to deal with it, you know what I mean? I can't dig into his heart and find where that is, but it does. If we fail to say it, not only are we failing to acknowledge the truth, then we are failing to address the problem. Whether or not that was the forum to do it, that may be up to debate and the question of whether or not he came for his heart or he was doing as it's solely a campaign tool. I can't get there.
You know, that's an interesting point. And I thank you for helping me say what was in my heart. And I just couldn't get it out. I mean, why go to this big public forum for that? I mean, what was the, you know, what's the
My conversations that I typically had, and I've, on the bench, I have mentioned race. I used to wouldn't do it from the bench, but I decided to because I had an opportunity, me, judge, you, defendant, to speak to something that I thought might change your mind about the way I'm doing things. But I understand the pain you feel in the public forum, but I do say it. I do say it when I talk to defendants, even on TV, about what I want for my people. I'm not trying to get elected to anything, though.
I'm following you. And
when I speak from the heart, and I want to hear, maybe there is somebody that I can touch by what I do say. So I can't, you know, hammer the brother for having said it in public, because I've said it in public. And that's why I'm saying, until I can dig into his heart and know why, I can't get but so mad, because it is the truth, and it is a truth that has to be addressed.
I guess that's why they say the truth hurts, isn't it?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. We haven't talked a lot about the response or the reaction to it, his speech, and whether or not he'll do something like that again, as compared to the immediate, swift, and very negative reaction to similar words from Bill Cosby. What do you think the impact of what he had to say is, if anything?
I don't think it's going to be the way it was for Bill Cosby, and I don't know why. It is a gut reaction. He was responded, and I'm not quite sure why that would be. I think it would be odd, and I can't put that into words. I'll join your camp on that one. I don't really know what will happen. I don't know what the response will be. I haven't heard an immediate negative response, but it's early on.
Well, you know, it's interesting that here you and I are two, you know, educated black adults, and we're having a hard time talking about this, perhaps because we're in a public setting ourselves in terms of how we feel about it and what we think the reaction should be to it, and trying to second guess whatever motives Senator Barack Obama might have had in saying what he said. It just goes to show that this is something that goes very deep, doesn't it?
Yes, it's a very emotional issue, and when everybody comes to the table, they're looking to say something that is true, but not damaging. We have to say, here's a problem, but we're not blaming the victim. And that's where, and, you know, place responsibility and not place blame, and in this soundbite society, it is difficult to say what you're going to say in such a pithy and short way that people understand you are acknowledging responsibility, acknowledging a problem, without placing blame on the victim. It's hard to say that all in one sentence.
It absolutely is. Judge Lynn Toler, thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you.
Judge Toler is the star of Divorce Court and author of My Mother's Rules, A Practical Guide to Becoming an Emotional Genius. New Jersey native Regina Bell burst onto the R&B scene with the hits Make It Like It Was and Baby Come To Me.
Silver moon shining on my bed, beside my pillow, light the pathway to bring that man to me.
Now, more than two decades later, she has released her very first gospel album, Love Forever Shines.
God is good. I said that he saved my soul, and then he brought me out of darkness. God is good.
I recently sat down with Regina to talk about the new direction of her latest musical venture.
You know, I'm told that this new CD of yours is a lifetime in the making gospel project. What inspired it?
Just a number of different experiences. It's something I've always wanted to do. And first and foremost, God, he's just been such a keeper and such a covering from place to place, country to country. All the different places I've traveled, he's always brought me safely back home, and this was my way of just saying thank you. And I know that it was his goodness that has gotten me this far. And, you know, through this record, I'm able to kind of touch on some different things in my journey.
Well, let me pursue that with you a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Do you think that it was your faith that pushed you to this music? Or was it the music that pushed you toward your faith?
Absolutely my music that pushed me towards faith. I didn't come out of the box having faith. No.
Really?
No. I learned as I went along. And then when things got hard and I actually had to have faith, the way the Lord showed me how to trust him and believe him is I had to go back and look back and think about all the things that I came through. I mean, I shouldn't have made it this far. You know, all the people who said I couldn't sing kind of stood in my way to keep me from doing exactly what it is that I do. And then for the fact that, you know, I had a really bad temper growing up, you know.
Did you?
Yeah, so.
How'd you get over that?
Music.
Or have you gotten
music.
Over that?
Music. I absolutely have. It's music. Music definitely calms the savage beast because it gave me an opportunity to focus on something that I absolutely loved. And I knew that that opportunity would be taken away if I got into, you know, I was smart. I had a bad temper, but I was still smart.
Mm-hmm.
And so the thing was is that, you know, my mom didn't play. You know, she was the overseer as it pertained to academics. So you didn't do well in school. Music is the first thing to go.
I got you.
You know, I wanted to make sure I could do
that
my music.
That you could do that. You know, you talk about writing on the CD and that you wrote a number of the songs. One of them I want to talk to you specifically about.
Okay.
It's called Almost Slipped.
All right.
And
the Almost Slipped.
Yeah.
Almost Slipped.
Uh-huh.
I took my eyes off of God.
Yes, I did.
I almost lost my way. Draw nearer, nearer to the love. Yeah. Listen. Truly the Lord has been good to me.
Here it is. I'm doing the best that I can do. I'm, you know, trying to serve God. I'm contributing to the household by being on the road and doing what I have to do. Trying to raise my kids, not to be knuckleheads and, you know, trying to be supportive of my husband and all the different things. And I was looking around at, you know, different people that I knew didn't even have a regard for God, you know, just didn't care. It was all about them. And it seemed like they were the ones who never had problems. You know, I had to deal with a foreclosure. I had, you know, my husband and I, because we have been able to be in different situations financially, we've been in position to help different people. We put some people through college. We've helped people with their mortgages. Just, you know, people who just needed a hand. But then when it came time for us to need help with what we were going through, you know, there was nobody because, you know, we were always the ones to help. And I looked around and I started feeling sorry for myself. And I was like, these people don't even care anything about you, God. And here I am. I'm trying to be the good, you know, Samaritan, trying to do what's right. And then I went into the sanctuary, and he says, you know, I put something in you that money can't buy. And so I was able to live my life on that. I was able to stake my claim on that and hold my head up, even despite the situations that I was going through.
Mm-hmm.
And not only did I go through it, but I went through it and came out on top.
Well, let's talk about success, because you had great success, particularly with this song. Whole New World, which you did a duet with Peabo Bryson for the Disney movie Aladdin. I suppose it really was a whole new world of success for you, wasn't it?
It absolutely was. I mean, I can't even explain to you what that song has done for me. And it's not just the financial success, but it's also just the fans coming and telling you that this song was played at my wedding. And you realize you become the very fabric of people's lives.
And you won a Grammy for it, too.
Yeah, a couple.
Not too bad. Huh?
Not too bad at all.
A couple of more things before we let you get out of here. One of them is this. It's about the CD itself. Here's a note that I wrote about the title track, Love Forever Shines. It sounds like the old Regina Bell, but it's contemporary. Mm-hmm. And then I wrote for track number 2, Can't Nobody with the choir, that this is more traditional sounding gospel. Mm-hmm. Which gospel sound are you most drawn to?
The very last song is really more of where I like to go because that's comfortable. That's home for me.
And your word says you're everywhere, but I can't feel your arms, and this pain's way too much to bear. Yes, it is.
then you said to me, you said, look in the mirror again. There inside of you, here is where I've always been.
You are married to a former NBA player who is now a pastor at the New Shield of Faith Ministries in Atlanta.
That's right, John Battle,
John
y'all.
Battle.
That's my baby.
Here's my question. Is it hard for your children to be preacher's kids in today's environment, do you think?
Yeah, because, you know, they get from me all the time, you know, you're the pastor's children, so you have to lead by example. So they can't slip up. So that becomes difficult for them because that walk is not just in the church. Although my son, I swear he doesn't hear me. but, you know, I love him dearly. He's my only son, and it's probably difficult being in a house full of women anyway. But I think it is difficult for them, but it's not a task that they can't perform, and they've successfully done it this far. So, you know, I'm proud of them.
Maybe that'll be the title of your next CD, God is Working in So Many Ways.
Ah, how see, you're trying to help us.
Regina Bell, thank you so much for
thank
coming in.
Thank you, Tony, for having me. It's been great.
Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter Regina Bell. Her new gospel album, Love Forever Shines, was released last month.